we are starting our discussions today with IFRS 17. I give the floor to Andrea.
Thank you. So at this meeting, we've got three types of things we'd like to talk to you about. One is an update on the discussion of the Transition Resource Group meeting from the 4th of April. Then we've got a few sweep issues. And finally, we would like to ask you to set the comment period for the exposure draft. So, Laura.
So the first set of papers are 2A and 2B, which Andrea mentioned, provide an update on the most recent TRG meeting that took place on the 4th of April. 2A is a summary of the meeting, including a discussion on investment components, and the board also received an update on that discussion last month when you were discussing a clarification to the definition of an investment component. 2B is a log of all TRG submissions received to date, all of which have been covered in a TRG meeting. In terms of next steps, there are a couple of things to note. Firstly, as many entities are now at an advanced stage in their implementation, submissions are starting to now cover more narrow aspects of the requirements, or they have included specific fact patterns which might not be applicable to a wide range of stakeholders. And so a number of the submissions for the most recent TRG meetings have not met the submissions criteria. At present, no further TRG meetings are scheduled. Stakeholders can continue to submit questions, and a future meeting might be scheduled depending on the nature of any new submissions, and also depending on whether a discussion of those submissions would provide helpful education at this stage in implementation. Finally, any stakeholder comments or questions that relate to the forthcoming exposure draft on amendments to IFRS 17 should be included in the comment letters to the exposure draft. Okay, so with that, I'd now like to hand over to the board in case you have any observations or questions on papers 2A and 2B.
That doesn't seem to be the case.
So paper 2C sets out some sweep issues on the ED of the proposed amendments to IFRS 17. The first issue relates to investment return services. So in January, the board tentatively decided that in the general model, the contractual service margin should be recognised in profit or loss on the basis of coverage units determined by considering both insurance coverage and investment return service, if any. And at that meeting, the existence of an investment return service was linked to the existence of an investment component. In this paper, the staff proposed breaking that link and instead setting criteria to identify when an investment return service exists. And we're doing this because we think that that an investment return service can exist in some contracts without investment components, for example, some deferred annuity contracts. The criteria we propose to set are set out in paragraph 13 of the paper. I also just want to note that neither this paper nor the January paper discussed how to weight insurance coverage and any investment return service in terms of how you determine the coverage units. That weighting is a matter of judgment for the entity. The analysis in this paper of the deferred annuity contracts differed from that discussed at the April TRG meeting. It leads to the same conclusion that an investment return service might be provided by such contracts, but it gives a different reasoning, a different rationale for that. Because of this, we asked TRG members if they had any feedback on the analysis in this paper that we could then report to you. Mostly, there was support for the direction of the analysis in this paper, but one TRG member expressed concern about disruption to implementation and unintended consequences. Other TRG members suggested variously moving to what they describe as a more principle-based approach, which would be the identification of coverage units based on whatever services the entity thinks the contract provides. Some wanted to give more guidance on the criteria that are in this paper, in particular what we mean by a positive investment return. And some wanted to allow an accounting policy choice over whether the determination of coverage units should include investment return services. Now, the staff acknowledge that it's hard to strike the right balance between setting clear criteria with supporting guidance for when an investment return service exists, and allowing practice and judgment to develop as people implement the new standard. So with that, I'd like to hand over to you for your comments and discussion.
Thank you. I do understand the direction that the staff is aiming for. And actually, I think this is one of the compromises we can make. And I think the idea is good. But one problem is how do you define the positive investment return? Does it include time value? Or if it includes only time value, can you still say this has a positive investment return? Or do you expect something beyond the time value of money? I'm asking.
Well, we've discussed various aspects of whether we should give more guidance on what a positive investment return should be. We, at the moment, aren't proposing to give more guidance on what we mean by that. You need to take that criterion in the context of the other two. So you have to, the policyholder has to have a right to withdraw money, and the entity has to be doing something to provide that investment return. But beyond that, we aren't at the moment thinking we will put in any other guidance.
Okay.
I agree with the proposed expansion, if you like, to the different scenarios that could be considered for having an investment return service over and above the investment component. So this idea that there could be circumstances where there's a return of money, but it's not strictly speaking an investment return service. I think that's a helpful thing. It seems to me that we've also made one slight change, consciously or unconsciously, I'm not sure which, in the drafting in paragraph 13 relative to the decision, as I remember it from January, whenever it was, which is to make it sound much more determinative that if you had this list of three things, and ticked the three things, that you would definitely then have an investment return service. That then does mean, as you've said in your tee-up, that you have to go away and think about what benefits you've got attached and what weight you give to them. But it does mean that you could be starting off with a sort of, you've already ticked the investment return service box and then you've got to do the analysis. Whereas I think in January we said that it was necessary to have an investment component, but that in itself wasn't determinative.
Yeah.
Personally, I would prefer it if we modified what we've got wording-wise in 13 to say that you can only have an investment return service if you have these things, these three things, but then we're still really asking people to look at the definition of an investment return service and make the assessment of whether they think they have one, and then going on and making these weighting decisions so it's not so black and white that these three criteria are determinative.
Mm.
In relation to tax question, I think I would agree with you. I don't think we want to get too prescriptive about what this positive means. But given the number of comments and questions I've heard about whether or not, in particular, it means that in a negative interest rate environment, you couldn't have a positive investment return, even if it was above the sort of risk-free negative rate, I wonder whether it's worth making an observation in the basis that would note that it is possible that you could have a positive investment return conclusion in a negative interest rate environment, which at least is a signal to people that by saying positive here, we don't necessarily mean it always has to be bigger than zero. Because I think we all would agree on that, and that at least helps answer that question without becoming too specific on what we mean by positive investment return.
Yeah.
Nick?
Thank you. So I welcome the introduction of the criteria. I know this has been a difficult area to get criteria right, so I welcome the diligence of the staff in doing this. I think it will better reflect the economics of certain transactions, and clearly that's helpful for users. As suggested, I'd keep the weighting issue a matter of judgment, I think, as we discussed before. I think we do have to be cognizant of the potential disruption to implementation, but I'm not sure it's undue disruption. Certainly there are benefits to users from a better expression of the economics of the transaction, so I'm happy and support the introduction of the criteria.
Amaru.
Excellent. I'll just come back to tax and so on the positive. That was, first of all, I do agree with staff's fine-tuning to capture these transactions. I totally agree with Nick. If it's for the benefit of users, a better reflection of the economics, it's very welcome. But I really struggle with the positive here. And I started thinking in a negative interest rate environment or a zero interest rate environment, what positive mean? When I naturally translate this to my original language, Portuguese, positive means something above zero at inception. Then, of course, positive in an interest rate environment means something above the market rate, including risks eventually. So I understand the staff's idea of not adding guidance, but I think the number of questions you already indicated, and as Sue stressed, myself, Tak, and maybe others, I think we need a little bit more. I would eventually ask why we need the word positive. You might have a very good reason. When I exclude positive, I think I would get to the same answer when applying the proposal. So I do not have a brilliant idea on how to describe it, but I think we need to provide a little bit more, because this can be read in a negative interest rate that if it's above the negative, but it's still negative, it's considered to be what we aim to capture here. So that's my take. But I do agree with staff. I just would like to us to think a little bit more on the wording here.
Mary?
Also, broadly, I'm supportive of the staff proposal, but want to offer just a couple of cautions. I think, in general, we should not be trying to provide more guidance on any of these points, although I think that the several comments we've had around positive investment return, it maybe says we have to say a bit more about what we mean by that, but I think we should stay away from saying guidance is it's these parameters or these items. I think it's more about explaining what we mean. I think it's on the disruption to implementation. It is, I think, the test is undue disruption, and I think it's helpful to hear from a range of people about what their views are. But overall, we've heard so much from others about the need to address this issue that I think that there may be some cost to it in terms of disruption, and I think we've got the right balance here, so I'm glad we consider it. But it is not a barrier to me. But it is very important to me that when we do this, it is not cast as, which you know, or perceived to be introduction of an option to identify an investment in return. So I think that means emphasizing that paragraph 13 are criteria, not indicators. And, you know, Sue's point was a different one in terms of deciding. It's saying that these are necessary, but they aren't sufficient, as opposed to it's optional to do that. So I think that's more around messaging, what we're trying to communicate. And last, I'll just go back to the two papers Laura covered. I think there's a lot of interaction. You know, we've drawn tremendously on the TRG and the very good work that the TRG members and the staff have done. And it's been really important to have the board updated. And I think that what you've done and put out into the public domain about it is very useful for tracking it in detail. So even though we didn't have questions on those papers, I think that is an important part of the package. So thanks.
Daryl.
So a couple of points, and I think I'm largely agreeing with what other people have said. I think I'd like to place
maybe a lot of emphasis on two of Sue's suggestions, which I think are really important. I think when we made the decision in January about necessary but not sufficient, to use Mary's words, that was a conscious decision because, or taking into account the effect that this might have on implementation. And I think that is a change potentially from what staff have recommended, if I'm reading paragraph 13 correctly. So my view would be not to go with the recommendation exactly as worded, but to amend it for that. And I think that is important in the context of this package of amendments that we're proposing. And then I think the other thing is I agree with the comments that have been raised around positive investment return. But I think, again, it's important that we don't change anything in the words of the standard itself, but I think something in the basis will add colour to what we mean. Positive is relative to something, and it's what that relative is. And I think what we're trying to capture here is the circumstances in which the entity is providing and the policyholder is receiving some kind of service. That's the objective of this, and I think it's positive in the context of that we're trying to target. The suggestions that you got around the principle-based approach, I can sort of understand why people are getting themselves there, but I think we need to sort of go back a couple of years and realize that not too long ago, that was our actual recommendation. And people were very concerned about that at that time, with a long lead time, about the amount of effort that would be required to identify the various different services that might or might not exist within and how they would do the allocation and et cetera. I think we are where we are now because we listened to them at that point, and I think we should be continuing to listen to what we heard at that stage.
I support the staff recommendation, and following up on this discussion around the word positive, I think that if among ourselves we have already identified that using that word positive has some form of ambiguity, I don't think we should leave it there. I don't believe either that the basis for conclusion should be used to that effect, because basis for conclusion is where we explain our decisions. It's not where we provide information to that. We don't want to provide guidance, but we still want to give a steer as to what we expect. And I don't think that the right place to do so. I don't know, but either we change the wording, avoid the term positive, and talk about, I don't know, is expected to bring a benefit of an investment return. I don't know what the proper words would be, but that would be my position on this issue.
Martin.
And I agree with staff proposal on this positive return. I think the staff tried hard to find the right term, what it is, and to define it, but I think it was not possible, and I think it's the best which we could come up with. And I think this positive, I think we have to explain it somewhere, maybe in the basis or others, because I think it can have different, as Daryl said, relative to something. So the negative, it can also be absolutely negative, but relative positive to the market return. We have kind of a situation where we have high inflation, even a zero rate, for me, would be positive if it covers the card of inflation, which otherwise is negative. And so so many circumstances where I think, okay, then the company, the insurance company, or the entity providing a service to me, which I find positive compared to doing nothing with the money. And therefore, I think it is hard to define, and therefore, I think this positive, we have to explain it a little bit.
Just a quick word on the... So Martin just reflected what could eventually be the initial discussions when we have this in practice. But just a quick word on the basis for conclusion that I do agree with Francoise, and I just would like to stress that in many, many countries, in particular in the area where I'm more familiar with, Latin America, the basis is not included in the general regulation. So this can eventually create significant disruption in the implementation whenever it's explained in the basis but not very clear in the standard. So I would really suggest us to have in the standard and not in the basis whatever is necessary to apply as we expect to be applied consistently what we are proposing.
Yes.
Given the structure of 17, where we've got the main body of the standard, if you like, and then we've got a lot of B paragraphs already because of adding extra colour to the...
Yes. We could...
The non-trivial requirements up the front. I wonder whether, to be responsive to the points that Françoise and Amaro made, whether an alternative would be to have something along the lines of 13 in the main paragraphs, and then a supplementary explanation of some level in the B paragraphs that at least makes this observation that you could have a return which is, I think the words Martin used, negative in an absolute sense. It would still be, you know, that's not what we mean, you know, plus zero, more than zero.
I think we'll try and take this into drafting, so we'll try and make sure that we explain as clearly as we can what we mean, particularly with respect to the negative-positive return.
Without getting too prescriptive.
Without getting too prescriptive, and then make sure that the basis explains as clearly as possible why we did what we did, and so the two will come together.
Could I just check that if we also change the wording, so as Sue was saying, in paragraph 13 at the moment it says that investment return service exists if and only if these things are met, to change that so it's consistent with what we decided in January, that it should, so that these have to be there for an investment service to exist, but they're not an absolute indication,
not
that they're not determinative.
I think
Sue had good language in terms of an investment service exists only if they're present.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Can we support staff's recommendation?
Revised.
13, one absent. Okay.
The second issue in paper 2C relates to whether we should amend IFRS 17 so that it doesn't require separate disclosure of investment components and refunds of premiums. So discussions with the TRG have highlighted different concerns about this difference between investment components and refunds of premiums. For some contracts, it's important that we're clear that the possibility of cancelling insurance coverage in return for a refund of a premium does not create an investment component. And we need to be clear about that, because we need to make sure that when a claim is made, the requirements in IFRS 17 don't lead people to think that they need to exclude some amount from revenue if there is no refund of premiums in that amount. And to do that, we have the board tentatively decided to clarify that the definition of an investment component is an amount that's repayable in all circumstances. However, that clarification caused some TRG members concern that for different products where there is an investment component and a refund of premiums when a claim occurs, that we are now saying that we need to identify those two amounts separately. The staff didn't intend to require separate identification in those circumstances, and it's not needed in terms of measurement or recognition of revenue and expenses. But there is a requirement in IFRS 17 to disclose investment components in the reconciliations, the roll forwards of the insurance contracts. So we propose amending that disclosure requirement so that it can also include refunds of premiums, so that people don't need to separate these two amounts out in those circumstances. Everybody?
Okay. Agreed?
Yeah.
We were not asked for a decision.
Right at the end.
Oh, okay.
You're efficient with the use of
words. Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
The next issue is an amendment to clarify that changes resulting from amounts lent to policyholders and the waivers of amounts lent to policyholders are excluded from insurance revenue. So some contracts in the scope of IFRS 17 include a loan component. The payment or receipt of amounts lent to or repaid by policyholders shouldn't give rise to insurance revenue. But paragraph B123 of IFRS 17, which lists out how you determine insurance revenue, doesn't include these amounts as amounts that should not be included in insurance revenue. So the proposal in the paper just corrects that omission.
Do we agree?
13-1 absent.
And then the final issue in paper 2C is on mutual entities. So IFRS 17 applies to insurance contracts within its scope, regardless of the type of entity issuing them. So it applies to insurance contracts issued by mutual entities if they're IFRS preparers. And we think there are great benefits for insurance contracts to be accounted for in the same way by all entities. IFRS 17 requires the measurement of insurance contracts to include all cash flows within the boundary of the contract that are expected to be paid to policyholders. Now, this includes both discretionary cash flows and amounts expected to be paid to current and future policyholders. There's some discussion in the basis for conclusions of how these requirements affect mutual entities, explaining why there are no special requirements in IFRS 17 for mutual entities, in particular why we didn't keep the mirroring approach for those entities. Now, these paragraphs in the basis define a mutual entity as an entity for which the most residual interest of the entity is due to a policyholder and not a shareholder. And so the paragraphs explain that when liabilities are measured applying IFRS 17, such entities might therefore report liabilities greater than the recognised assets, even though they're solvent for regulatory purposes and economically have no equity rather than negative equity. Some stakeholders don't think that this result provides useful information. They suggest that we amend the requirements in IFRS 17 for mutual entities. However, the staff do not recommend any such amendments for the reasons set out in paragraph 27 of the paper.
Thank you. I disagree with the proposal. I think we have to make clear that these paragraphs apply only to some mutual. I think by doing so, it can alleviate lots of confusion. So, and also my worry is we are going to issue or we have issued educational material. So although education material is not mandatory things, but as long as it's educational, practice really has to refer to that educational material. So therefore, we have to make clear that this educational material do not necessarily apply to all mutual insurer. And thing is, mutual is a simple word, but the system of mutual varies jurisdiction by jurisdiction. And in some jurisdiction, a government or law requires to keep a certain reserve. And those reserves will not be paid to the any policyholder. It should be kept until it resolves. And of course, eventually, when it comes to liquidation, maybe those reserves may be shrinked. However, basically, they were required to keep those reserves. And then they act like as if they were a normal corporate. So therefore, when it comes to, when we consider the comparability and the usefulness of IFRS 17, it would be much easier for them to allow as if they are corporate. There might be such a situation. And of course, in theory, I do understand what the BC is written. However, if we say it should be applied to all the mutual, so then that causes a lot of friction. So therefore, the idea was just this paragraph applies to some of the mutual. Would solve the lots of friction.
I mean, I think it's important to IFRS 17, the requirements apply to all entities.
Equally, yeah.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter whether they are called a mutual or are called something else, or, they still need to include in the fulfillment cash flows discretionary cash flows that they expect to pay to policyholders and future policyholders. And all the basis for conclusions does is that, say, for some entities, and then it goes on to describe these entities as being ones where policyholders have the residual interest, you know, that could have the consequences that are set out in those paragraphs. But that explanation in the basis, it doesn't change, you know, getting rid of that would not change the requirements of the standard, which are that all entities have to include in the fulfilment cash flows amounts that are expected to be paid to current and future policyholders, including discretionary amounts.
Yeah, of course, I understand it doesn't change the requirement, but the problem of this BC is it is written a little too much, I would say, as if you are saying that if you apply IFRS, you wouldn't recognize any profit or loss or any equity. So it's a little bit misleading, and it does not provide useful guidance, but rather at a glance it causes more confusion. So therefore that's why there are voices saying this is confusing. So I would think this BC is redundant now, because the purpose of the BC was to explain why mirroring, we wouldn't provide the mirroring and then explain the mutuals. But if we keep it, then it is regarded as if the textbook for the mutual. So that causes some misunderstanding between the conversation between auditors and preparers, and which we shouldn't keep such a friction element. That's what I think.
But so you just plead for...
My preference is just delete, but...
But that doesn't change the reality.
That doesn't change the point, but because it's written a bit too much in general, and standard is already clear, then it's not necessary.
First of all, I would like to make it perfectly clear that I support that the measurement model of IFRS 17 applies to all insurance contracts in the scope. But I have sympathy for what Tak has explained. People refer with it, and that's why also I think the least guidance we include in the basis, the better, when we keep the basis for its purpose. But nevertheless, even when we explain why we have made decisions, we provide insights into the understanding of how the requirements are set, what they mean, and so it's helpful for people to read the basis, and they do. And where you have, in a basis for conclusion, some ambiguity arising, in fact, it may distract people from the understanding of what the requirements are. So what we want here is that the measurement model applies to all insurance contracts, and that people look very carefully at what are the rights and obligations that arise from those contracts. And I think we would be better if the term mutual entity was removed from the basis for conclusion, and we would just describe the entity that has the particular circumstances of having the residual interest being liable of that residual interest to its policyholders. We would get rid of the term, because you have in the real life a number of entities that are called or call themselves mutual entities and do have very different economic arrangements. So I would plead to having this possible distraction from the correct understanding of what we require removed.
Martin.
I agree with staff recommendation, and because I don't think, if we're changing that now, it will not change any requirement. And I think maybe people will then come to a wrong conclusion that we have changed the requirements, which I would not agree, because our... As explained in the basis, we have a standard which applies to insurance contracts and not based on which entity have issued this insurance contract, so it is comparable and same for everybody. And I understand the issue for these companies which have the situation, because these companies may be currently under floor, have accounted for this part with this discretionary as equity, and now they have to change, and it is a liability. And I think for a company that uses all its equity is not a good thing, a difficult thing to explain. But maybe they can disclose that. They can say, okay, this specific liability, which so there may be some room for to make it at least transparent. But I think one other solutions, man, we cannot come up with defining a kind of mutual entity which has that and what is it. I think it's difficult. So I have sympathy of people having a problem or an issue with that, but I don't know how we should change it, because our main objective was to have a standard for insurance contract which is comparable regardless of it is issued by a bank, an insurance company, a mutual, or by Hans Hogerforst or Martin Edelman. So it does not matter. And therefore, I think the basis reflects that, and therefore we should not change it, and that has effects.
Mary.
Martin's comments are really the first part of mine, which is, if we were having this discussion before we issued the final standard, I think I might have a different reaction to having issued this basis, what would be perceived if we withdrew those paragraphs, you know, regardless of what effect we think it has. So I'm not supportive, like the staff recommendation, I am not supportive of removing those paragraphs at this time. I don't know if, and I think starting to fiddle with them, and by fiddle, that could sound dismissive, but tweaking them, changing the wording, you know, Francoise's suggestion about eliminating the term mutual, again, could have perceptions that are not aligned with what we mean to do, although I have sympathy both for the issues created more generally and for, you know, some of the concerns that Francoise raised. I don't know if this is time just to stop and apply the rule of when in whole stop digging, or whether it's a time when it would be helpful to think about whether there's more educational or other material that after we get through this could be useful in, you know, in explaining that the term mutual that we used in the basis is not, let's say, a self-applied label, but, you know, we were referring to certain fact pattern. And the other thing, I think it is not much comfort, but I'd be interested, not in this document, not at this time when we have, you know, priorities to get this out, but for the staff thinking about whether, if we were to say anything more, it would be helpful to point out that if an entity that wanted to analyze its fulfillment cash flows between the portion that relates to current policyholders and those that relates to future policyholders, if they wanted to, that it still is fulfillment cash flows and therefore a contract liability. But I don't, having done a superficial think about this, don't see any reason they'd be precluded from doing that further disaggregation of their liability if they thought it was meaningful information to present. It doesn't answer all the problems, et cetera, but just trying to show some things that might help with the communication. But I think this is, to address this fundamentally would be a fundamental change in the standard, and it's not something we can contemplate at this time. And we shouldn't pretend we are.
So I'm probably going to say something quite similar. Martin said, but in slightly different words, and the different words matter a little bit in the way I've been thinking about it. So the starting point for me is that I have some sympathy with the fact that the accounting for these types of entities in some jurisdictions has changed, and they are still dealing with how to intuitively describe and explain that change. But I think for mutuals who are using IFRS, they want to be compared to non-mutuals that are using IFRS, and I think in doing that, what they need to be able to do is measure the same insurance contracts the same way. So that when you pick up a set of financial statements of a mutual and a set of financial statements of a non-mutual, you have an understanding that the liability means the same thing for both of them. And I think that is exactly what the standard achieves. So I actually think the standard is in the right place on this. And I think creating an exception for mutuals would create this anomaly that if you picked up a mutual set of financial statements, you could only ever compare it to another mutual. And that's not the space that mutuals want to play in. So I think that's probably the first, or mutuals that are applying IFRS want to play in. I think that's the first thing for me. The second thing for me, and it's interesting that two topics ago we discussed the basis. And I think the basis can play a role in informing what the board was thinking about or describing what the board was thinking about when it wrote a particular standard, and that may be helpful to people. I think these paragraphs in the basis are doing exactly that. Withdrawing these paragraphs that essentially are not trying to override anything, have no power to override anything in IFRS, I think creates the perception that we think it will change something in the standard. And I think that would actually be completely the wrong thing. So I'd probably agree with Mary again, perhaps in slightly different words. If we were writing this basis again now, I may have changed the words a little bit to make it less awkward in terms of the way it's worded. But there is nothing in these basis paragraphs that is an incorrect portrayal of what the standard says, and I think people just need to be reading it properly.
We wonder whether maybe what we could do with sort of minimal disruption is add a footnote to the basis, to those paragraphs that said, you know, some entities may describe themselves as mutuals but not be required to pay the residual interest to policyholders, and to emphasise that these paragraphs are about that latter group, not the ones that just label themselves as mutuals.
Yes.
I would just add that we do not define mutuals in the standard, and thus
we can work on.
Sue, finally.
I think I'd agree with the comments made, particularly by Martin and Daryl. And I think the other thing that is important for me is that even if the basis didn't exist, the requirements in the standard are that you need to include in the fulfilment cash flows the amounts that will be paid to policyholders current and future, even if those amounts are discretionary. And I think my concern would be that some maybe haven't fully appreciated that, particularly for the discretionary piece. And I fear that by deleting the basis paragraph, they may feel that they're justified in taking that incorrect reading of the words, and so I worry about the unintended message that it sends. Mm. I think the footnote might be helpful to address at least a core issue.
Including the footnote, can we support the staff's recommendation?
13-1 absent.
Well, that brings us to the end. Sorry. Comment period.
Agenda paper 2D discusses the comment period. The staff recommend the board to set 90-day comment period for the forthcoming exposure draft of proposed amendment to IFRS 17, reflecting the fact that amendments are narrow in scope and the need to minimize any disruption created by the amendments. The Due Process Oversight Committee approved the 90-day comment period at its April meeting. Now we'll hand over the board to discuss.
A vote?
90 days?
Oh, Martin.
It is?
Martin.
Yeah. Yeah? Okay.
13-1 absent.
Okay. Can I close off now?
Yes.
The reason why I was a bit in a hurry is because I wanted to say something nice about Andrea, who is with us at this table for the last time, I understand. So that is, of course, a very sad occasion, but a memorable one. Andrea, you started with us in the year 2002, I understand. That means you have been with us almost 17 years, or perhaps even fully 17 years. Not quite as long as it took us to design this standard, but you witnessed a big part of it. And of course, we know you very well as the leader of the insurance team who did this monumental task. And throughout this whole period, I've always heard very positive feedback as about you as a team leader, that you were always very inspiring and that you mentored a lot of the junior staff working on this project. Of course, you were getting a little bit bored with the standard at a certain point, as we all are, but you took the opportunity to broaden your horizon within our organization. You did a lot of organizational improvements, project management, staff development, improvement of drafting techniques. So you really, your contribution to the to the organization, to the ISB, has been quite enormous. I should also mention that I, as you know, I visit the insurance staff very frequently, and one of the reasons is that there is an unending reserve of sweets and candy. I have a suspicion that you are partly responsible for that. So thank you for that as well. Andrea, thank you very much for your fantastic contribution to the ISB. We will really miss you a lot. I'm sure that the insurance team will miss you a lot. We're going to replace you by one of the most senior staff members that we have, Henry. We couldn't find anybody more suited for the job. You're starting a new career. I understand that, even though you must be sorry that you cannot be here for the very end of the standard. But you never know how much time that takes. So I think it's wise for you to move on. I will do the same in 2 years. So I wish you a lot of success. And again, thank you so much for everything that you did for us.
Thank you. Thank you all too.